saw established, very big companies seemingly staking out new big positions, which we think is exciting.
Two lease sales attract millions of dollars in bids on the North Slope. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, questions about the North Slope borough runoff election.
The most troubling issue is whether the count was accurate, and the evidence that we have suggests that it was not.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Two lease sales today showed that the oil and gas industry is still very interested in the North Slope. Just 2 days after the way was cleared for a pipeline into the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, the industry snapped up all the available acreage near it today. And in a separate sale, the state made more money selling North Slope leases than it has in years. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The Bureau of Land Management took in a little more than $3 million in high bids for the NPRA, announced Alaska Region Deputy Director for Resources Ted Murphy.
Three companies submitting a total of 20 bids for 17 tracts. Total acreage receiving bids, 141,739 acres.
You heard right, three companies. ConocoPhillips, which added acreage it already held, and two new companies, Woodstone, and one naming itself with numbers 70 and 148 LLC. That company was an active bidder in the state lease sale as well. Bids in the state sale were extensive and took hours to read. The state sold hundreds of lease tracts and brought in about $21 million, something Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan was very encouraged by. He said that's far more than any recent sales.
Our look is the average kind of combined Beaufort, North Slope has been about $10 million a year average, maybe south of that, and we obviously doubled that.
The state offered both onshore and offshore tracts. The highest per acre bid came from Pioneer, which only bid on a few tracts but paid out $878 per acre for them. There were new companies heard from, not just 70 and 148, but Royal and Nordac. There were also bids from the oil giants already involved on the North Slope and in the Beaufort, but significantly, Sullivan said, in new places.
You saw some established, very big companies, not just nibbling around the edges of their current units, but seemingly staking out new big positions, which we think is exciting.
Shell bought nearly all the available onshore leases in Harrison Bay. ConocoPhillips turns out to be interested in acreage south of BP's Badami field, which has a pipeline but not much oil flow. Great Bear added to its shale oil properties, and Repsol, which already has four rigs busy this winter in the Colville Delta, staked out significant new acreage onshore and off. In talking with reporters afterwards, Sullivan said he's paid repeated visits to Repsol and believes that company now considers its Alaska oil and gas reserves its top asset. But the Parnell administration commissioner was not about to leave reporters with an entirely rosy picture of how inviting the state's investment climate is for the oil industry.
But to be honest, there was a number of companies that we spoke to that certainly had an interest who did not show up today.
Sullivan said it's important not to read too much into one lease sale, and the industry is notorious for playing its cards close to its chest. But they will do their best to find out the reason some players chose not to come to the table this time around. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A new North Slope borough mayor has been on the job for 3 weeks now, but there are still big questions about the runoff election that Charlotte Brower won on November 8th. George Amawak, who lost to Brower, is contesting the election on several grounds. The wide-ranging accusations are spelled out in a detailed 11-page statement that was requested by attorney Dennis Cook. The borough hired Cook as an independent investigator to help look into the claims. Timothy McKeever is the lawyer working on the case for Mauwak. He says it certainly appears the election was mismanaged in a number of ways.
The most troubling, I think, is the fact that the borough clerk's office kept releasing results of the election that were inconsistent with one another, and also inconsistent with the records of how many ballots had been issued and how many ballots had been returned. So the most troubling issue is whether the count was accurate, and the evidence that we have suggests that it was not.
There are allegations that the borough clerk was drunk and had an accident after picking up ballots from the airport from villages. What's known about this incident, and where were the ballots?
We know that the borough clerk was involved in an accident driving a borough vehicle at or near the airport in Barrow, and this occurred a few days after the election. We don't know for sure that she had ballots in the car. We believe that she may have, but that's sort of the extent of what we know. The airport records that indicate she was involved in an accident and that it occurred near the airport, and we believe that it's likely that she had ballots, but we have not yet been able to determine that fact for sure.
You're also alleging bribery in the form of buying votes. What evidence do you have that this happened?
Well, attached to the updated grounds for the election challenge is an affidavit from an individual in Barrow who says he was approached and offered $100 to vote for Charlotte Brower. And so that's the evidence that we have at this point to support that allegation.
There are charges that vote totals do not add up to the number of official ballots, and those numbers remained in flux. What are you presenting as evidence of this inconsistency?
We have printouts of the ballot counts that were generated by the borough clerk's office, and those vary from count to count. In other words, each time more ballots were counted, the numbers are inconsistent with what they had said before, not just because there were more ballots, but also because some of the numbers that they had stated before had changed. And so the whole process of counting the ballots is confused and unclear.
Despite all of these issues, the election was certified. What was the justification given for that certification?
It's unclear. Normally, when there's an election and there's an election contest, the certification process does not happen until after the contest is addressed and the issues raised by that contest are resolved. It's unclear why the borough assembly decided to vote the same night that they canvassed the ballots to certify the election, since there was a contest pending. So we don't understand why they did it and believe that they acted precipitously and it should not have been certified.
Does it make it harder for you to make your case now that the election has been certified?
Well, the borough assembly did vote to conduct an investigation. They've hired an independent investigator to assist in the process, and we're proceeding. There have been certain changes in the borough administration as a result of the election being certified, and that's complicated things a little bit, but we're confident that we will be able to develop the evidence to show that the contest is justified and to demonstrate that the election was not done properly.
And Mr. McKeever, what are you asking for? Do you want the entire election thrown out and start over, or what is it that you're seeking?
Certainly, if the election was mishandled and mismanaged to the extent that it appears to have been, then I think the folks in the North Slope Borough should have an opportunity to either vote again or to have to the extent it's possible, and it may not be possible, to have the current election returns counted in a more fair and appropriate fashion, and see what the outcome is. But the bottom line is, this is an important position. It's important for the North Slope Borough. It's important for the people of the North Slope Borough to have confidence that the vote was done correctly, the counting was done properly. And at this point, it just doesn't appear that that was the case. We need to get to the facts and then figure out what's the appropriate remedy.
Timothy McKeever is a lawyer working with Georgia Mauwak to contest the Barrow runoff election. Borough officials returned calls late today, stating they will arrange for response to these allegations tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska has one of the lowest flu vaccine rates in the country, and the CDC is trying to change that.
Essentially, just as long as the flu is continuing to circulate, it's really never too late to get your vaccine if you haven't done so already.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
A new study shows major energy savings if an in-state gas pipeline is built. The Alaska Gasline Port Authority commissioned study looked at savings that would result from a pipeline from the North Slope to Valdez with a spur from Glen Allen to Anchorage. The project also includes export of liquefied natural gas, including shipment along the Yukon River and to remote communities like Yakutat and Bethel. Port Authority Project Manager Bill Walker laid out the study results at a press conference in Fairbanks yesterday, saying switching from diesel to natural gas would result in major energy cost reductions, even in a remote community like Bethel.
It could have cost savings up to 65%. Fairbanks, up to 80%. Of course, one of the differences between 80 and 65 is in Fairbanks there's no liquefaction cost.
Walker said Fairbanks would have the cheapest gas of any community because of its proximity to the gas line and North Slope, resulting in a low transportation tariff. The study also includes estimates of cost savings for individual consumers.
The estimate is $3,000 per household per year of cost savings in Fairbanks.
The estimate is for people who live on a gas distribution network in the city and is based on projected oil and gas prices. The Energy Savings Report is one of three the voter-created Public Gas Line Group has commissioned to vet the proposed in-state pipeline project. Walker said the studies are dispelling negative myths about a state-financed gas line to Valdez.
Is it economic? Absolutely. Does it make money? Yes. Is there a market? Absolutely there's a market. Does it reduce the cost of energy in Alaska? Absolutely it does.
Walker said it's time for the state to sever the AGIA contract with TransCanada in favor of a state-owned Port Authority project. The North Slope to Valdez line hinges on exports to Asia, where gas is more valuable than in the shale gas-flooded North American market. He said the AGPA project requires a $4 billion investment by the state. A new report says Southeast Alaska's sea otter boom has cost the region close to $30 million. Most is income lost as otters consume shellfish and crabs that otherwise would be harvested by commercial divers and fishermen. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
Otters were reintroduced to Southeast in the 1960s, and for a while, they remained a rare sight. But recently, their population has boomed, mostly along the outer coast and in southern Southeast. That means the voracious eaters are consuming more and more sea cucumbers, sea urchins, and the giant clam called gooey ducks. Those are species commercial divers harvest.
We don't know what's going to happen with the dive fisheries in the long run. It doesn't look very promising, though.
Phil Dougherty is executive director of the Ketchikan-based Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association. It recently released an economic report from the McDowell Group, a Juneau-based research firm. The report estimates regional otter numbers will soon hit 20,000, more than double the population about 8 years ago. And by 2015, it will more than triple.
We don't see a real management plan out there that would even slow down the growth, let alone trying to keep otters out of areas where they aren't in yet.
The report estimates otters have taken about $22.5 million in the species divers harvest, plus Dungeness crab, using the wholesale value. Add in businesses that support the dive and crab fisheries, and the figure grows to just over $28 million. That includes $9 million of sea cucumbers, just over $4 million in gooey ducks, almost $4.5 million in sea urchins, and about $5.3 million in Dungeness crab.
That's a very narrow way of looking at sea otter's role in the ecosystem.
California activist Jim Curlin lobbies Congress to continue protecting sea otters. He says their return to areas where they were virtually extinct is good for the marine ecosystem.
When you have large colonies of sea urchins, which occur when you don't have sea otters, they can destroy kelp forests, and sea otter predation on sea urchins actually enhances the productivity of kelp forests, and scientists have documented this effect in Southeast Alaska and elsewhere over decades of studying this.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act bans most hunting. Alaska natives can harvest otters for subsistence use, but they can only give or sell whole pelts to other tribal members. Other sales are allowed if the pelt is substantially altered, such as being turned into handicrafts or clothing. Alaska's congressional delegation is pushing legislation that would allow natives to sell whole pelts to anyone. Dougherty says the Dive Fisheries Association funded the recent report to share its concerns.
We need to make sure that everyone is fully aware of what's going to happen with our shellfish fisheries in Southeast Alaska. And if at the end of the day, people still don't want to react to it and will allow the sea otter population to wipe out the shellfish fisheries in Southeast Alaska, that's the decision that we need to know, that our divers need to know at this point in time, so they can make a decision as to what their future is going to be.
A separate U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service research effort is trying to determine the extent of sea otter population growth. It's shown a 13% boost in southern Southeast. Additional research, due out soon, will provide numbers for the northern part of the region. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Alaska has one of the lowest flu vaccination rates in the country, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control. Alaska's flu vaccine rate is 37%, the second lowest. South Dakota has the highest at almost 56%. The CDC has declared this week National Influenza Vaccination Week in an effort to convince more Americans to get the flu shot. Dr. Lisa Ann Grosskopf is with the CDC's influenza division. She says flu season is well underway.
We have 30 states that are experiencing at least sporadic flu activity. The flu season typically doesn't peak in the United States until around January or February. It can continue to circulate, though, through as late as May. And one thing we do want people to keep in mind is essentially just as long as the flu is continuing to circulate, it's really never too late to get your vaccine if you haven't done so already.
Are you seeing any especially bad strains popping up this year?
We're not seeing anything especially bad. The flu viruses that are circulating this year so far are a good match to the strains that were included in this year's vaccine, and we're expecting that the vaccine should provide good protection against most flu illness.
Do you have specifics for Alaskans? What has the flu season been like here so far this year?
As of our latest data, we have Alaska reporting what we would call sporadic activity, definitely not widespread activity. We are anticipating, of course, that, you know, we're still not into January, and things do tend to pick up usually during that month as we go into February.
And how long do the vaccines work? How many months are they good for?
That can vary somewhat from person to person, depending on their age and their immune status. There have been a number of studies that have looked at this, and we do know that overall, when you get a vaccine, the level of immunity that's provided by it will decline over time. For some groups, depending, again, on age and immune status and health status, it may decline faster than others. Generally, people will be protected through the year. You can't really count on getting protected through a whole second season, though, which is one of the reasons that we recommend annual vaccination.
And Dr. Groskopf, how have flu vaccine rates changed in recent years?
Well, we do have some recent data from so far this year from the National Flu Survey, which indicates some gains being made in some areas. For example, this year so far through November, we're showing better coverage in children and better coverage among pregnant women as well as in healthcare workers. There's still some groups in which, at least according to this survey, coverage isn't as good as where we would want it to be, in particular among adults between about 18 and 64 who have chronic medical conditions.
And what would you say to those hardy, tough Alaskans out there that say, I can make it through the season. I don't need to get a vaccine. If I get the flu, I'll be all right. How important is it for people to get this vaccination?
We think it's very important that people get this vaccination. Flu can be potentially quite a serious illness for some persons, particularly if you're in one of the risk groups that's a higher risk for complications, and those would include people at the extremes of age, either over 65 or the very young, under 5-year-olds and definitely under 2-year-olds are at higher risk of complications. Pregnant women are at higher risk of complications, as are people with a number of chronic medical conditions, including things like asthma, other lung diseases, heart disease, diabetes, and immune system problems, as well as a number of other conditions. But even if you don't have one of those conditions or don't fall into one of those groups, the flu can be potentially serious for just about anyone, and there's really no way to predict. So the best way, that really the best means that modern medicine has to protect against this illness, which can be severe for some people, is to get an annual flu vaccine.
Dr. Lisa Ann Groskopf is with the CDC's Influenza Division. Sponsors of the initiative to reinstate the coastal management program are ready to start gathering nearly 26,000 signatures needed to take their ballot question to the next level. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell certified the measure last night. The former coastal management program worked with local governments, developers, state agencies, and the federal government before the legislature allowed it to close on July 1st. Kodiak Island Borough Mayor Jerome Selby, one of the prime sponsors of the initiative, points to the importance of the coastal management program, not just for people along the coast, but statewide.
The Coastal Zone program is really the only program that really allows Alaska's people to have a lot of input into federal decision-making processes before the decision is made. And if we don't have a Coastal Zone program, realistically, we then have to react to a decision that has already been made. And as everybody knows, that's a much more difficult task.
He said the only remaining way to change existing federal decisions is through litigation. Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello, also one of the prime sponsors, says the steering committee has organized supporters in all 40 House districts and raised about half the money sponsors believe it will take to get the petitions before voters. They have a year to get enough signatures to qualify the question for the 2014 ballot. But if enough signatures are gathered before the start of the upcoming session in January, the issue would be placed on the 2012 ballot. Governor Parnell has not said anything about the initiative. However, his staff in an email today pointed to a permitting office within the Department of Natural Resources saying, quote, "This allows communities to weigh in numerous times for each project under review." Botello says there's a strong reason for industries to support the initiative. He says it won't work to manage development in the absence of a federally approved coastal management plan.
Interested in the process which allows for voices at the local level to be heard. Those voices aren't binding, but they are an opportunity which the proposed efforts in the Department of Natural Resources do not account for.
The Division of Elections is preparing booklets in which supporters can gather signatures for the initiative. No specific release date has been set, although Lieutenant Governor Treadwell said he has already begun assembling cost estimates from various departments to determine the fiscal impact of the initiative. Governor Parnell and First Lady Sandy Parnell held the 99th annual holiday open house at the governor's mansion yesterday. It's among the most popular holiday events in the capital city, with eager citizens lining up around the block to get a picture taken with the first couple. KTOO's Danny Peterson has more.
Look at the camera. The aroma of more than 24,000 cookies, 100 pounds of fudge, and several gallons of hot cider filled the mansion lobby as Parnell gave a message of thanks for this holiday season.
I think just as we gather in this great home of the people of Alaska, it's good to remember and give thanks for all we have and for who we are as a people. It's also good to remember the men and women of our military who are overseas right now and their families, and also just to give thanks for them. So that's our message, is one, to let's enjoy this time as a community, and let's give thanks for who we are as a people.
This year, the governor says he will split his time between Juneau and Anchorage to visit family in both cities. The Parnell clan is embracing the newest member of the family.
We're working on getting a fifth stocking here for Austin, for our son-in-law, but we're going to enjoy our newest member of the family as well.
Yeah, layers of happy memories are happening.
Parnell's daughter, Grace, married Austin Adams this past year at the mansion. The house itself underwent about $1 million worth of repairs and weatherization improvements, which, for the past couple of months, displaced the first family to an apartment in town.
We rented an apartment here. We had workers inside the house. We're looking forward to actually being back in the house this week.
As the crowd grew outside, Parnell's cabinet members took the initiative by serving cider and cookies to them on platters. Visitors gave a variety of reasons for coming, from wanting to see the improved mansion, a taste for something sweet, or simply staying in touch with the community.
Because I really wanted to see the governor's mansion.
To see all the improvements to the governor's mansion and eat some free cookies.
It's good watching the little kids having fun. It's great for us big kids getting out.
My name's Jacqueline Fonda, and I came to see the governor.
To see the gingerbread houses, because I went to DZ and they have them.
To hopefully get a hug, second year in a row, from the governor!
Among the school groups in attendance were Desanta Kahini Middle School, Little Orcas from Auk Bay Elementary, and the Thunder Mountain High School Band. Reporting from the mansion, I'm Danny Peterson.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks and Ed Schoenfeld and Danny Peterson in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. Support for AK comes from the Federal Aviation Administration, providing information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates four decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.